Case number 12-5412, Calling Pause on its own behalf and on behalf of its members et al. Appellants versus Joseph R. Biden Jr. in his official capacity as President of the United States Senate et al. Mr. Bohm Durant for the appellants, Mr. Caballero for the appellees.
Mr. Bondurant, good morning.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Emmett Bondurant. With me is Steve Spaulding, who is staff counsel for Common Cause. The district court in this case, in ruling on the standing issue, erred in three very fundamental respects that prejudiced the court's entire view of the issue of standing and was really outcome determinative. First, the district court did not presume, as required by the decisions of this court, that the plaintiffs are entitled to prevail on the merits of their constitutional claims. He ruled precisely the opposite. Though citing LaRoche or Muir that is the rule, he ruled that he was not convinced that the plaintiffs had any procedural rights in the Constitution to majority consideration of bills in the House.
Let's assume that on your constitutional theory, the plaintiffs did have a right, a procedural right. Now, so far as I can see, our cases that say that strict causation and redressability need not be established with respect to a procedural right, which all stem from the footnote in Lujan, talk only about procedures that have been designed to protect the interest of the plaintiff that is affected. So what exactly is your theory as to what the Constitution, what concept in the this is a portion of the Constitution that's not literally stated, what is it designed to achieve?
Your Honor, I believe first that the question of whether the provisions in the Presentment Clause regarding majority vote were designed to protect the interests of House members, on the one hand, who pass legislation and send it to the Senate, or beneficiaries of legislation, is itself a merits issue. Secondly,
that seems to do something very strange with our cases about the extent to which we give the plaintiffs a pass on causation when it's a procedural claim.
To the contrary, I think the Supreme Court has ruled precisely on that. Let me give you several examples. Munoz Flores is a case in which the origination clause was allegedly violated. The government's argument in that case was it is irrelevant the effect this has on individuals because the purpose of that clause was merely protect one house from invasion by the other of its exclusive turf to originate registration, revenue-raising legislation. The Supreme Court said, quite to the contrary, the government's claim that compliance with the origination clause is irrelevant in ensuring individual rights is an error. The court has repeatedly emphasized the Constitution diffuses power better to secure liberty. In recognizing this, the court has repeatedly adjudicated separation of powers claims brought by people acting in their individual capacities. And then specifically with respect to one house.
This is not a separation of powers case, is it?
It is a separation of power between one house.
Well, that's not what we usually mean by separation of
power. The court specifically said.
Let me ask you on another topic. Why isn't this case moot with respect to at least the non-House members? I mean, these two statute or bills were in the 111th Congress when the Democrats controlled the House and Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker. We're now in the 113th Congress. We have a different composition of the House and a different party in power. So why isn't the case moot with respect to them?
If you argue mootness, you're essentially saying that this is not a injury that is capable of repetition but evading review. The cases in election cases especially, and this is just another election case in many respects, because the mootness arises out of the shortness of terms of Congress.
But it has to be the same. Are you suggesting that the DREAM Act and the Disclose Act will come up again and be passed by the House in the 113th Congress? How the heck does anybody know that?
I am suggesting that they have a right to majority consideration without the obstacle of an unconstitutional procedure in the Senate. They have, in fact, been reintroduced in successive Congresses, and they will be reintroduced. They have not been passed by the House yet. If introduced in the Senate, they may face exactly the same obstacle, which is exactly the same issue. What has the Court said about procedural rights cases? Number one, that the standards on redressability are relaxed. Number two, a plaintiff does not have to show a certainty that if the procedural obstacle is removed, that he would receive the benefit that he seeks. That is your ruling in Wild Earth only a month ago. That is the ruling of this court in the city of Dania.
It's different because you're talking about NEPA cases, right?
Excuse me?
You're talking about environmental impact statement cases?
In that case, that was true, but in Chadha and in Clinton v. City of New York, those were statutory cases under the presentment clause.
Let me ask you a merits question. Your submission is that the House members vote in majority in favor of a particular statute, the DREAM Act and the Disclose Act, is nullified because of the 60-vote cloture requirement, right?
That is correct.
Well, you know, the House or the Senate Majority Leader, under the rules and by custom, can refuse to even bring up a statute for a vote in the Senate. So does that make the majority leader of the Senate unconstitutional because he's nullifying a statute passed by the House? And that has happened with some degree of frequency in the last several years.
If the majority in the Senate had the power, as the House does, to bring something up over the objection of the majority leader, then you might well be right. That essentially was Skaggs versus Carl.
So the majority leader, every time he refuses to bring up a bill that's passed by the House, is acting unconstitutionally. Is that your submission?
We do not have to reach that question.
No. I'm asking you if that is what follows from your argument on the merits.
That is not a rule of the Senate, as Rule 22 is. Rule 22 is a rule of the Senate that specifically says...
But if your remedy against Rule 22 is available, why don't you have an equivalent remedy against the majority leader? What difference does rule versus particular order make in this context?
If the rule were declared invalid, then cloture on any motion would be by majority vote under the general principle of all parliamentary bodies that goes back to Balin. That would also mean that other matters...
Actually, there is a rule. It's Rule 19 of the Senate that's been interpreted to give the majority leader complete control over what bills get voted on in the Senate that have passed the House.
Interpreted only about 2 months ago in a manner in which I would suggest, as I did in my response to the Senate's submission, that raises itself very serious constitutional issues, and that the Supreme Court has ruled in no less than three cases that the houses of Congress are bound to follow their own rules, and that when, as Justice Brandeis held in Smith, the interpretation of a rule, including Rule 19, adversely affects persons outside the Senate, the question is justiciable. It's not a political question. It is a question of law, therefore not a political question.
Everything the Senate does affects people outside the Senate, one hopes.
That's correct, and that is precisely what happened here, that the exercise of Rule 22 affected the House members. It nullified their votes. Mm-hmm. And the fact the vote was not nullified in the House but nullified in the Senate, it was nullification nevertheless. Just as the vote of Senator Kennedy was nullified by the president's untimely pocket veto was nullified. Just as the Nebraska House members' votes were nullified, they were counted in the Senate. They were nullified when the lieutenant governor cast a deciding vote that had the effect of nullifying them. And the Supreme Court has said clearly in Raines, our ruling in Raines stands for the proposition that when a legislator's vote that would have been sufficient to pass or defeat legislation is nullified, that legislator has an interest in preserving the effectiveness of his vote that is sufficient to give him standing.
One of the puzzles for me in your case is that you've sued the vice president and several other individuals, none of whom are senators, none of whom engage in voting for cloture. And can the vice president vote for cloture?
He cannot vote for cloture.
Okay, so none of those individuals that you've sued are in any way, shape, or form responsible for the harm you're alleging.
That was precisely true in Powell versus McCormick.
The sergeant-at-arms barred him from coming in.
So. The sergeant-at-arms ultimately was held to be a person who effectuated a decision in which he had no role in making.
So
he was acting
under orders. This leads me to wonder why you didn't name any senators, and I think the obvious answer is the speech or debate clause.
Well, of course, that's the obvious answer.
But the speech or debate clause also applies to officers of the Senate under the Supreme Court's decision in Gravel. So why shouldn't these individuals that you've named also be entitled to speech or debate clause protection? By the device of not naming a senator, you don't get around the speech or debate clause, and that's what the Supreme Court held in Gravel.
To the contrary, number one, the speech and debate clause does not apply to the vice president. He is the presiding officer of the Senate.
Well, he doesn't have a vote anyway. He can't give you the relief.
He does have the power to rule on points of order, and if a rule of the Senate is unconstitutional, he could, in that exercise of that power, so declare it and decline to enforce it. He is a proper party. Number two, in Powell against McCormick, the precise argument you had made was made. That is, that the speech and debate clause protected functionaries of the House who were acting under orders, who did not make the decision not to seek Powell. And the Supreme Court's answer is, when an individual who works for the House under direction of the House is carrying out an unconstitutional order, he is not immune from suit. And that is...
He only gets immunity when he's acting legally? Is that the idea?
I think
Powell has been overtaken by a series of cases, not the least of which is Eastland versus United States Servicemen's Fund, Gravel, other cases.
Let me
back up a minute. You said that the vice president doesn't get speech or debate clause protection. When the vice president is presiding over the Senate, he has speech or debate clause, doesn't he?
No,
protection? Where do you get that from?
The vice president is not a member of the Senate.
Are there any cases saying that? I don't think so.
There is no case that has ever held that a person who is not a member of the Senate, not an employee of the Senate, not a delegate carrying out delegated powers of the Senate, is protected by the speech and debates clause. In fact, Judge Williams, you have written an opinion in which you talk about the narrowness of the speech and debate clause. It does not protect every functionary. It did not protect Senate employees, for example, from discrimination cases from improperly firing a staff member who was not carrying out functions.
But that goes to what's a legislative function.
This is not the legislative function as far as the speech and debate clause. You have a far greater intrusion.
Isn't it right at the heart of the legislative function?
Excuse me?
Isn't it right at the heart of the legislative function?
The question is whether or not it is a constitutional exercise of legislative function.
That's the merits argument.
That is correct. And if
but
you
that doesn't help on speech and debate.
If you assume we are correct on the merits, that the Senate has violated the presentment clause by imposing a de facto 60-vote requirement to pass legislation. Then you have to come, then if you buy the speech and debate clause argument, you essentially say the Senate is the only body in the United States that can, with impunity, violate the Constitution. And there's nothing the courts can do about it because you're immune. There is no such case.
The executive branch can violate the Constitution sometimes without suffering liability. That's what sovereign immunity is.
Sovereign immunity does not protect the executive branch for violating the Constitution. Sovereign immunity or separation of powers did not protect the legislative and executive branches for jointly passing legislation that they thought was constitutional that turned out not to be. Sovereign immunity did not prevent a person who was affected by the origination clause in Munoz Flores from challenging a bill that originated and he claimed in the Senate when it should have originated in the House. He ultimately lost on the merits because the court held that that was not a revenue bill, it was something else. But the court has never gone so far as to say the speech and debate clause would completely immunize the Senate from any sort of action that violates the Constitution. If that were true, checks and balances would be badly upset because unlike legislation that is subject to the check of being passed by the other House or being vetoed by the President, rulemaking in the Senate is subject to no check by the other House.
This is getting into the substance, but I'm just wondering, was the Senate in violation of the Constitution in the period from its creation to 1917, which created the first opportunity to cut off debate at all?
Let me correct you factually. The first rules of the Senate had the previous question motion from English parliamentary practice, which allowed the majority to end debate by simple majority vote. In the period from 1816 to 1806, when that rule was eliminated, to 1834 to 1840, there were no filibusters in the Senate, and the Senate cut off back debate by majority vote. It was only when somebody discovered that they had eliminated the only procedural mechanism that allowed a senator to cut off majority vote that the filibuster began. The 1917 rule was intended to provide a mechanism where none existed before. But the question is still, can you have a de facto rule that legislation cannot pass in the Senate over the objections of the minority without getting 60 votes? And I would respectfully suggest that Chadha and Clinton versus City of New York clearly answered that question, that the presentment clause applies, that the presentment clause provides a single, carefully considered, carefully crafted method for passing legislation, and that is by majorities of both houses, and that even in that case, where the House, the Senate, and the President were in agreement to give the President a power to line item veto because the House and Senate recognized that they could not restrain their own avarice in appropriating funds far beyond the budget. The court steps in and says, even though that may be convenient, even though it may make perfect political sense, it violates the presentment clause and enforced it at the instance of individuals who are not beneficiaries other than an indirect sense of the statute that were involved. That is, the individuals involved did not have any enforceable legal rights under the two line items that were vetoed.
All right. Any questions?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Caballero.
May it please the Court, Thomas Caballero from the Senate Legal Counsel's office, and with me at council table is Patricia McBrien, Deputy Senate Legal Counsel. I just want to quickly start with the speech or debate clause to make a few clarifying points. The first is that it is certainly a position of Senate that the Vice President is covered when he's presiding over the Senate by a speech or debate clause. In addition, as
is there anything in writing to that?
I don't believe it's ever come up in a case, but because the Vice President, in presiding over the Senate, is conducting legislative duties, the Supreme Court held in another context, the County Commission, I believe, that when executive officers do legislative duties, they're protected by the legislative privilege. We don't see any reason one could interpret that not to apply in the federal context. I'd also like to point out the court correctly noted that the Gravel case held that Senate officers and employees are covered by a speech or debate clause when acting in the legislative sphere. And Gravel specifically talked about the Powell case and explained that why speech or debate did not apply there was because a person failing to pay Representative Powell was failing to do a non-legislative act, pay somebody. That wouldn't be covered by speech or debate. But when an officer acts within the legislative sphere, and as the court also noticed, there's nothing more legislative than debate on the floor of a House or Senate, they would be covered.
But who are they? Besides, I've forgotten it. It's the Vice President. But who are the other individuals?
The Secretary of the Senate, the Sergeant-at-Arms of the Senate, and a Senate parliamentarian. They make no allegations against these people whatsoever. They sue them because of their theory, incorrect, that they avoid the speech or debate clause bar by suing them.
Right.
But again, that theory is incorrect, and they don't present any allegations as to what these people did to cause their injury. In fact, as we know, the Vice President wasn't even presiding over the Senate at the time that the cloture votes taken on the bill.
Isn't that enough to end the case?
It certainly would be, and we put in our brief that would be an alternative ground for affirming the dismissal below. I'd like to quickly turn to the redressability point that the court has pointed to. They asked this court to line item edit a Senate rule, strike out the 60-vote requirement for cloture on legislative matters in Rule 22. And this court itself recognized that any such relief would be raising the most acute problems, as it said 10 years ago in the Judicial Watch case, which involved the cloture rule. It also said it would be novel judicial interference with the Senate's internal rules. So such relief would be beyond the power of the court. But even if the court felt it could give that relief, said, okay, we'll rewrite the cloture rule, that would have no effect whatsoever on the legislation that failed to pass the 111th Congress, and it would have no effect on requiring the Senate to take up any piece of legislation now. Obviously, it's completely within the Senate's discretion as to what legislation it considers, debates, or holds any vote on. And as the court recognized, any legislation it considered now would have to be voted on in the House, which is controlled by another party than it was.
This is really an argument as to how much leeway the footnote in Lujan, as interpreted by the court since then, gives the plaintiff on matters of redressability, right? Because after all, the premise of that footnote is that the plaintiff certainly need not be assured that things will come out better once the procedure he advocates is installed.
Correct. And I think that points to the problem with this whole concept of procedural injury in this case. As the court noted, that comes out of the administrative law context, often environmental cases. Mm-hmm. And there, the court reverses the agency action for failure to abide by its own procedure and sends it back to the agency, where the agency re-undertakes its action. Here, the court can't resend the matter back to the Senate. Those bills lapse in the 111th Congress. Moreover, it can't require the Senate to reconsider anything. And I think that redressability problem demonstrates why this whole concept of procedural injury at its outset has no applicability to the legislative context whatsoever. In addition to the point the district court made that there's no express procedural protection in Article 1 for individual plaintiffs with regard to particular pieces of legislation. In addition to the redressability and the speech or debate, the court below decided there was a political question, and we would seek affirmance on that ground as well. If the court has no further questions.
I have one. Has the DREAM Act passed the Senate now?
A very similar piece of legislation was passed in a bill that passed in the last session.
This border security economic opportunity.
Yes, I cited it in my best. Correct. It's not identical to the bill that failed. And obviously, the House has to act on it. The House hasn't taken up that legislation. That's correct.
The majority leader of the House has the same power that the majority leader of the Senate has.
The majority leader.
The speaker.
Exactly. Working with the speaker, the majority leader sets the agenda in the House. That's correct. All right. I thank the court.
All right. Thank you. He's out of town. All right. Mr. Bonner, you're out of time. Why don't you take a minute?
Thank you, Ron. First, the argument that this would be a rewrite of the Senate rules is not well taken unless you're prepared to say that the Supreme Court rewrote the Affordable Care Act when they severed some of its provisions. Severance and rewrite are two things, and severance is allowed, in fact, it's encouraged, unless it is utterly clear that the legislative body would not have chosen a rule without the severed section. Secondly, it is not true that the procedural rights do not exist in the legislative context. Chadha was the legislative context.
Yeah,
individual.
Chadha is really a case where the court said that Chadha suffered as a result of a statute that was not a statute.
Chadha suffered.
There simply was not a valid statute there at all.
Chadha suffered as a result of a procedural violation of the presentment
clause.
Well, you
call it procedural, but and I recognize the Supreme Court used the word procedure at least once in that opinion. Basically, it found that there was no valid statute, period.
Because there had been a violation of procedural clause, and that was the violation of Chadha's right. Yellen against United States was a procedural rights case in which Yellen refused to testify before a House Un-American Activities Committee because they had not followed their own procedure in ruling on his request to be allowed to testify in executive session. The Supreme Court ruled that they had violated their own procedures, that he could not be punished in contempt, and that he had a procedural right under their rules to a decision. And even though that decision was not likely to be in his favor, he nevertheless had standing. Clinton is a procedural rights case. Those people had no standing to sue, no cause of action under the statutes or the appropriations that were line item vetoed. They were indirect beneficiaries, and it was the violation of the procedural right. And Northeast Florida Contractors, to pick up your point, Judge Randolph, in Northeast Florida Contractors, the Supreme Court held removing the obstacle to white contractors being considered for the business that had been subject to minority set-aside would not necessarily give them any business. There might not be any more contracts even let, just as the DREAM Act may never be reintroduced in the House. But nevertheless, the court ruled that it could remedy it by removing the unconstitutional obstacle.
So what do? We order the vice president, the parliamentarian, the secretary of the Senate to remove the Senate rule?
What you do is do what the Supreme Court has done in many cases, including Affordable Care case. You sever the 60-vote requirement.
Well, we've got an order. There's got to be an order. And the people that you've sued have no authority to do what you're requesting.
If the court enters a declaratory judgment declaring the 60-vote supermajority right provision unconstitutional and severing it from the statute, from the remainder of the rule can remain in effect. The Senate, by majority vote, can do whatever it then decides
is
appropriate.
In declaratory judgment cases, you still have to have a proper party. And if you're just declaring that the bulldozer, if it's used, will violate the zoning rules or something, you still have to sue the owner of the bulldozer. You don't sue the town manager who's not in charge of it.
The declaratory judgment that Mr. Powell was entitled to be seated was rendered against the sergeant-at-arms of the Senate, who had not made the decision, who had no power to do it, and the argument was made by the government, essentially the same argument that was made in the Nixon Tapes case. How would you ever enforce it if the House disregards it? And in footnote 87, the Supreme Court says that is an inadmissible argument. To presume that one of the bodies in separation of powers would disregard a court ruling that their action is unconstitutional is an inadmissible argument, and that is the argument you're making. And that is the argument that was rejected in Powell, and that is the argument that should be rejected.
I'm asking questions. I'm not making arguments. You're answering.
You need to wrap it up, Mr. Vonderick.
Excuse me?
You need to wrap it up. You're way over your time.
I thought I was through. I thought Justice Randolph had another question.
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.